Okay, so what I'm going to do is switch us back. So I'm going to remind you all where we were on Friday. What's that? They're still being compiled. I'll get them up on the web. Yeah, you know, the slides themselves will go up on the web. So yeah, there aren't any notes. The section on this is being put together as you walk, because this is all stuff we've been talking about doing and writing down for a while, and now we're talking about to you and writing it down as we go. Okay. Where we left off on Friday is we had talked a little bit about radiation. We did the word association game, thanks to Professor Scalise. Okay. And a lot of you associated the word radiation with cancer or yellow or bad, you know, basically negative connotation. Okay. And that's not uncommon. That's pretty much a cross section of our society as a whole, is that when the word radiation gets mentioned in conversation, it gets associated with a lot of fear. And while there are things to be feared involving certain kinds of radiation, not all radiation is bad. And I talked about some examples of sound, right? We rely on sound all the time. That's a kind of radiation. Light, we rely on that to see, for instance, or to feel the presence of heat, hot sources, so you know not to touch a hot skillet or a cook pot on the stove, okay? Heat is a kind of radiation. It transmits information in the form of energy from one point to another without physical contact. And you want that for a hot pot because you don't want to have to touch the pot to find out that it's boiling hot. And now you have to go to the hospital, okay? But even within radiation, there are two broad classes. There is ionizing radiation. And ionize means to remove an electron from an atom so that the atom no longer has it. And how many of you took chemistry either in college or in high school? Raise your hand. Okay, a large fraction, looks like all to most, okay? But the basic, you know, I can sort of, as a physicist, I can give you chemistry in one sentence. Chemistry has everything to do with the arrangement of electrons around the nucleus of an atom. There, I just explained chemistry to you. And for those of you who actually know chemistry better than I do, including my father, who's a chemistry teacher, you are allowed to drum at this point, because that's a gross oversimplification. There are many complexities to all of that. But if you had to do it in one sentence, chemistry has to do with the movement of electrons from atom to atom and where electrons are placed in an atom, in orbit around the nucleus. Okay? So ionizing radiation is when radiation comes in and does it has enough punch to pull an electron square out of an atom and remove it. For all intents and purposes, it's gone, leaving that atom positively charged. Electrons have negative electric charge. The atom is now positively charged, and that's referred to as an ion. Okay, so ionization, the process of making an ion. Now, atoms are quantum systems. I'll explain what that means in a bit. The key here is that what all quantum means is that things happen in discrete steps. If you put in energy in between the steps, you don't get the benefit of the next step. It just doesn't happen. It's not that it happens less. It's not that it happens somewhat. It doesn't happen at all. And that's 100 years of quantum physics that we've learned that tells us that over and over and over and over again in experiments. And I'll even demonstrate it to you in class today. Okay? If you don't put in enough energy to ionize, you cannot ionize. And therefore, you cannot change the chemistry of an atom or a molecule, anything like that. They're made from atoms. Non-ionizing radiation is the stuff that doesn't remove electrons from atoms. It might be capable of causing an atom to vibrate or rotate, really more a molecule. So a molecule could vibrate, okay, it could rotate. That can happen under the action of an electromagnetic wave that comes in, doesn't have enough energy to remove an electron, but can do other things to the molecule. It might even briefly excite one electron up to a higher orbit before it drops back down again. Okay, but ultimately it can't change the properties of the atom. Okay, it can't change its chemical properties, the number of electrons that the atom has. Now, I've been talking about electromagnetic waves, but I need to build a little bit of terminology for you about waves. Okay, so how many of you have seen waves before? Raise your hand if you've seen a wave. Water wave, okay, something like that. All right, so what can be said about a wave? Can you say something about where it is? Like specifically where the wave is? Why not? It moves, but that's okay because cars move and you can say something about where a car is. But why is it hard to say something about where a wave is? Right?
It's like a moving disturbance.
it's a disturbance. It's spread out, right? It's spread out. It's hard to define where the wave is and where it is not. And you can even see that on this picture. If I was to ask where the wave is, well, you'd say, well, it's kind of all over the place, right? And so we have a different language we use to describe a phenomenon like that, a wave phenomenon, one that's spread out in space. We talk about not where it is or what its momentum is. We talk about its wavelength, the length between two common points on repeated sections of the wave. So here you can see the wavelength illustrated from peak to peak in a neighboring wave, neighboring crest of the wave. The amplitude is the height of the crest. For an electromagnetic wave, this would be equivalent to the strength of the electric and magnetic field present in the wave, okay? Whereas the wavelength for an electromagnetic wave would be the distance between one peak and another peak, let's say, in the electromagnetic wave. And then finally, it's a little hard to illustrate in a picture like this, which is why this sketch didn't have it, but there's something called the frequency. And this tells you how often the same part of a wave segment goes past in some unit of time. So let's say we pick a point right here, and we have waves going by, and we count the number of peaks that pass that point in 1 second. And I find out that it's 5. So 5 peaks of the wave go by in 1 second. That wave is said to have a frequency of 5 per second, or 5 hertz. Hertz, H-E-R-T-Z, is the unit of frequency. It's named after Hymer Hertz, who was mentioned in the last lecture. Okay. So 1 over second, or per second, or hertz. Those are all ways of saying frequency. How often the same point on a wave passes a common point in space. Okay, so that's the language, wavelength, frequency. Once you have those things, amplitude, you basically can describe a wave even though it's not a phenomenon that's located only at one point in space. But you can describe it. Now, quantum physics takes over at roughly the scale of an atom. When you get to something about the size of an atom or smaller, you're in the quantum world. Now, the quantum world in reality extends all the way up to scales the size of us. It's just that the effects are so negligible, we don't really notice them. So, for instance, we don't notice that energy can only affect atoms in discrete steps. Because at our scale, the steps are so closely spaced, we don't even notice them. Okay? But if you get down to something the size of an atom and you start asking questions like, where is the electron? Thinking of the electron as a billiard ball that's in orbit around the nucleus of an atom. You start to ask questions like that, and you try to answer them using planetary mechanics, like the moon going around the Earth, and you get answers that are just wrong. They make predictions about the outcomes of controlled laboratory experiments on atoms that just aren't correct, okay? So what you have to do instead is think of the electron as a wave that's spread out around the nucleus of the atom, and from there you can make real progress. You can make definite predictions about the properties of the atom. Very powerful. Quantum mechanics is the basis of all modern technologies, like mobile phones, which we'll talk more about later today. So quantum physics, really, all it does, it's just a language of mathematics that relates properties we normally ascribe to a particle, something that has a definite location in space, like its energy, how fast it's moving and what kind of energy it imparts if it were to collide with something else. Its momentum, which is, again, a measure of its mass times its speed. Those things we can't really talk about for a wave easily because there's no one place where the wave is and where it is not. But waves have wavelength and they have frequency, and quantum physics lets us relate those things. It lets us relate particle properties and wave properties. A lot of popularizations of quantum mechanics try to make it sound really weird. They try to say, oh, it's weird because light behaves both like a particle and a wave. No, it's a wave. But if the wavelengths are short enough, it looks like it's a particle. And I'll give you an example. Okay, here's a simple analogy that will help you to understand why something that's a wave can feel like a particle if the wavelength is short enough. So let's imagine you're out on a lake. Okay, you're in a boat, you're offshore, you kick back in the boat, so you're laying down in the boat, you're looking up at the sky, and that's a little rowboat. Okay, so you row yourself out offshore, and you decide you're going to take a nap in the sun, which, as you'll see later, is a really bad idea without sunscreen. Okay. So you're just relaxing, and unbeknownst to you, a construction crew over by the shore is working on some bridge construction by the water, and there's an accident, and a large piece of metal falls from a crane, rolls down the shore, and smashes into the water. Now, if that happens all very quickly, so the metal rolls down and all at once goes into the water, this will cause a big wave to
suddenly form from the action of the water being displaced by the metal. Okay? If that impulse is very fast, the wavelength will be very short and the amplitude will be very high. So you'll be in your rowboat, and this wave, unbeknownst to you, will be propagating across the surface of the lake, and then it will hit your boat. So you'll be laying in your boat, and if the wavelength is shorter than your boat, all that water all at once will smack into your boat. Bam! And you'll think, I've been hit by another boat. Okay? And again, it's because all the water is piled up in a short wavelength shorter than your boat, so your boat feels the effects of that wave all at once. That's like an X-ray. Okay? An X-ray is an electromagnetic wave, a very short wavelength, and it can be seen to behave like a particle, but it's really a wave just with a very short wavelength. Okay, so the boat analogy helps you understand that. If, on the other hand, that accident happens and the metal rolls very slowly down the shore, and it displaces the water in the lake very slowly, it makes a long wave, you'll be laying in your boat, and your boat will rise and fall, because the wavelength of the wave is much longer than the boat. So the boat only feels part of the wave, come under it, raise it up, drop it back down, like surfing on the wave, okay? And so you'll feel, oh, that's nice, nice and relaxing, waves, very peaceful day, I can take my nap. You don't even know this, you just think your boat's riding the waves, okay? That's equivalent, for instance, to visible light. So red light, blue light, long wavelengths, much longer than an atom, okay? So atoms experiencing visible light are just kind of rocked by it as it goes by, very peaceful, very nice, doesn't feel intense or painful at all. Okay, so these are some analogies. Analogies have limitations, but they'll help you understand why a wave can feel like a particle. All of its energy being deposited all at once in a short wavelength. Okay? So I've already mentioned some of these things before, and this just illustrates on the atomic scale the way that non-ionizing and ionizing radiation can function. Non-ionizing on the left, ionizing on the right. Ionizing is pretty simple. You have an X-ray photon, a photon's a light wave, a light particle. Okay, this language becomes interchangeable in quantum physics. Comes in, hits an electron in the atom, has enough energy to strip the electron completely out of orbit, okay, and that's it. Now that atom is positively charged, it has a hole in its atomic shell, and it can become reactive. It may want to bond with something nearby in order to reduce its overall energy and make a favorable lower energy state, okay, chemistry. But other things can also happen if the waves are not strong enough to rip electrons out. They might cause atoms in a molecule, for instance, to excite, that is, have an electron go briefly up to a high orbit and then drop back down, and when it does it, it'll radiate a photon of light. Okay? Or it might cause the molecule to rotate or vibrate. Okay? So those things are all fine. I mean, those have uses that I'll talk about in a bit, but they're not changing the chemistry of those atoms. I mean, this is a violent thing that alters the atomic orbits of electrons and makes that atom potentially reactive with something near it. And that can have consequences biologically. Now, a couple of handy things to know. Here's some math. Yay, math, right? But the math in quantum physics is actually remarkably easy once you get past the difficult concepts that underlie it. If you want to answer the question, how much energy certain electromagnetic waves have, all you have to know is its frequency, okay? Or its wavelength. It turns out those things can be related to each other through the speed of light. So let's take the frequency as an example, f, okay? There's a constant in nature called Planck's constant. It's a very tiny number, and I've given it to you here in units that are convenient for atoms. The energies of things that happen in atoms can be measured in units known as electron volts. This is merely the energy gained by a single electron if it moves through a 1 volt potential. Imagine you have a 1 volt battery, okay, double A or triple A is pretty close, that's like 1.5 volts, and you're going to move an electron between its two terminals. That's a difference in energy of 1 volt, and the energy gained by the electron going from one terminal to the other is 1 volt. If it's a 1 volt difference, it's 1.5 electron volts. If it's a 1.5 volt difference, okay? These are tiny units of energy, and Planck's constant is even tinier. So Planck's constant is 4.136 times 10 to the minus 15. So basically what you want to do is put 14 zeros before 4136 and then write 4136. Put a decimal place all the way to the left of that. That's a tiny number, okay? But it's been measured very accurately over the years, or precisely over the years. And just keep that in mind. Okay, so all I'm ever going to do is show you frequency or wavelength. Those things can be related to one another through the speed of light. And then you just multiply by h to get the energy. And let's see what kinds of energies we're dealing with here.
Okay. So this is the first time I'm mentioning mobile phones. So mobile phone radiation, okay, because it is radiation, it's electromagnetic waves, have wavelengths that are actually roughly the size of us. Okay, so one wavelength of electromagnetic radiation is roughly the width of the human body and longer. Okay, we're talking about 0.15 meters up to 0.789 meters. So it's about a meter. The frequencies are given here. They're big in these units of per second. They're actually that should be megahertz. Sorry, that should be 10^6 megahertz. And then the energy over for those associated with those is about a million of an electron volt. Okay, so the energy that can be deposited by cell phone radiation is a million of an electron volt. Keep that in mind. How about infrared light? Infrared light has shorter wavelengths than mobile phone radiation. Okay, so in principle, more particle light. But let's see how particle light. Okay, infrared light, also known as heat. Okay. The military uses infrared viewing technology to read heat signatures in a battlefield or in close quarters fighting to look for a person that might be hiding behind some thin barrier, something like that. Infrared light is also used in safety systems, okay, for night vision and things like that. Very, very useful. We use it to cook. Obviously very useful for our species. Wavelengths vary between 10 and 1,000 micrometers. Okay, so 10^-6 meters. Frequencies are there, and we're talking about energies that are still fractions of an electron volt. So 0.001 up to 0.1 or so electron volt. Okay? Then we have red light. I'll just skip the wavelengths. Visible light, stuff we can actually see, starts at 700 nanometers and it goes to about 400 nanometers. That's what we can see. We experience a very tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. That goes from about 1.8 electron volts to 2.8 electron volts. Okay? Violet light packs more energy, 3.3 electron volts. Ultraviolet, okay, which we tend to associate with bad things like getting skin cancer, and you'll see why in a bit, that has energies that range, but I put something that's typical down sort of in the middle of the range, 6.2 electron volts. So that can be as low as 3.5 or 4 and go higher. And then finally, X-rays, which we know can do damage if you're exposed to them too much. Each of those for the frequency and wavelength I gave you here, they span a huge range, but we're talking hundreds of electron volts. Okay? So, again, keeping these numbers in mind, mobile phone, millions of an electron volt of energy. Visible light, 1 to 2 to 3 electron volts. Ultraviolet, 4 and up. X-ray, hundreds. Okay? We can come back to that if it's needed. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a demonstration for you here, and I'm going to show you the quantum nature of material. Okay? So I demonstrated something last time, and that was what's called triboelectricity. It's just electricity due to friction. So if I take this plain old like holiday paper bag I got a couple of years ago, and some off-the-shelf PVC pipe from Lowe's, which is like $1 or $2 for 6 cubits, something like that, and you can slice it up, you can rub it. What this does is it transfers electrons from the paper to the PVC. So I'm building up a negative charge, an excess of electrons on the PVC pipe. The cool thing about this is that electricity is like a fluid. You can transfer it from one vessel, the PV where it's trapped, to another vessel, like this tinsel. Okay? And let me switch so the folks in the back can see this. Okay, and that's still good? That's not bad, right? Okay, so just to show you, human body is lightly electrically conductive. This is bad if you get electrocuted, if you stick your fingers in a light socket or touch your tongue into a light socket. Please don't do this. Although it's less grating for us, I guess, if you do. Yeah, keep smiling. That's fine. I've done it too. I've electrocuted myself. I've done it more since I started teaching physics. Students like it when the professor electrocutes themselves. Okay. But I'm lightly conductive and I can drain that charge right off. Okay, so let me show you again. You can watch up there. Okay, now what's happening is that this is a metal, it's a Coke can, it's a paper clip,
It's some cheap holiday tinsel, some Christmas tinsel, okay? And I just glued the tinsel into electrical contact. It's just making physical contact with the paperclip. Paperclip is making physical contact with the can. All that's metal. These are just styrofoam coffee cups that I stole from our kitchen down the hall, and I hot glued them together. They don't let electricity move freely. The metal lets electricity move freely on, but the cups don't. They're what's called an insulator. So they're keeping this charge from escaping off the can into the table and then going to ground, which is where it wants to go. Electrons want to go to the lowest energy point. I'm stopping them from doing that. So this is kind of like a fish tank for electrons. I'm trapping them in here. So if I lightly brush the PVC pipe against the tinsel, I transfer some of the charge, and you see the tinsel is now repelled away from itself. And that's because it's picked up a net negative electric charge, and negative charges are like charges. They all repel each other, and it pushes the tinsel away from itself. Okay? And again, I can drain that light off. Watch. There we go. Not complete, but we can. There's still some stiffness left in the tinsel. So let me put some charge back on this thing. And I'm going to demonstrate quantum physics. Now, if I hit this with light, do that again, hit this with light of an appropriate wavelength or energy, it should be possible to strike the electrons and remove them without making physical contact with the device. Okay? So, to see if we can get this to work, how many people have mobile phones with them today? Great. Let's find out if mobile phone radiation can remove electrons from this thing. Take your phones out. This is the one time we're going to ask you to do this in class. If you have a friend you can call right now, even if they don't pick up, your phone will be transmitted. All right, so I want you to all make a phone call. And don't do it quite yet. I'll count down, all right? So at one, I want you to all hit call. All right, everyone ready? All right, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, call. Watch the tinsel. We're filling the room with deadly microwave radiation now. Thank you, Randy. Everyone ringing? Yeah? Okay, you're all transmitting right now. You've made connection with a mobile tower. Now, that's not directional. That's in all directions. So we're all transmitting. Has anybody noticed the tinsel drop down like it did when I removed the charge? No. Yeah, I mean, I can move this thing with wind, right? But it's still hanging there, okay? Okay, well, that suggests, it's not 100% conclusive, but certainly it must have filled the room with radiation. It suggests that mobile phone radiation is not capable of removing electrons from this can, okay? Now, mobile phone radiation has a much longer wavelength than red light. So this is a laser. It generates red photons. Green light. I'm colorblind. All right, so green light is right in the middle of the visible spectrum. Okay, so we're talking about 2 electron volts worth of energy per photon, so it's a millionth of electron volts per photon present in the mobile phone radiation. So without blinding anybody, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use radiation, I'm going to strike the can, and try to wash off the photons.
Ineffective.
Seemingly ineffective.
It's also getting blasted with all kinds of visible radiation.
Yeah, but maybe it's not enough.
This is a little pop quiz. What kind of radiation is predominantly coming out of that box? Infrared, very good. 90% of an incandescent light bulb is. Those are heat sources. That's a terrible lamp. That's a heat source.
Yeah, frankly, it's the most inefficient light source we've ever made. Come on, man.
Notice that the electrons are still on the
Okay, now, what I have here is a 253-nanometer UVC sanitizing wand sold to something you can wave over your toilet and kill bacteria. Now, that frequency of light, which is ultraviolet, can, in fact, kill bacteria and also do significant damage to your skin cells. Okay, so you never want to put your hand under it. It has a switch that if I flip it over and do this, it turns off. Okay, so let's see what happens when we expose the can to 253 nanometer UV.
you know, let's do it again.
Okay, visible light didn't do it. All that infrared didn't do it. Mobile phones didn't do it.
But this pathetic little, maybe few watt UV bulb can drain the charge right off. Slowly, but it works. Okay? This is called the photoelectric effect because light, photo, is knocking electrons, electro, out of the material. And it takes a very specific energy to do that. Every material is slightly different. But for aluminum, which is what that can is made from, okay, it takes about 4 electron volts to remove the charge. Now, specifically when people talk about the photoelectric effect on a metal, they're talking about ripping the electrons out of the outermost orbits of the atoms themselves. So if you just have a block of aluminum and you shine UV light with an energy of at least 4 electron volts, you can now generate an electric current in the material by knocking electrons out, leaving positive ions behind. Okay? So by blasting that with even just a little bit, and that bulb is not very powerful. We're talking about a handheld device running on batteries here. Okay? It's able to remove the charge where intense visible light couldn't do it, that box full of bulbs. The fluorescent lights in here couldn't do it. Your mobile phones couldn't do it, all calling at once. Okay? But a little bit of UV light, boom. A little bit of X-ray would do the same thing. Okay, anything with an energy greater than 4 electron volts has the possibility of not only knocking out an electron, but really picking it up to a high energy. That's the photoelectric effect. And that was one of the revelations. The explanation of this effect was one of the things that kicked off quantum physics. And that explanation was by whom? Anyone know? Einstein, yes. In 1 year, in 1905, he published 4 total papers, one of which won him the Nobel Prize. And it wasn't the one on relativity. It was the photoelectric effect one that won him the Nobel Prize. And it's interesting because he kicked off quantum physics by arguing, well, light could behave as a particle, even though everyone had thought it was pretty wave-like up till that point. And that whole confusion really kicked off an attempt to understand, well, what does all that mean? What's the real language behind this, and how do we understand atoms? Eventually, he sort of disowned the revolution that he kicked off, but that happens. Okay. All right, so that's a demonstration of the photoelectric effect. That's a demonstration of ionization. And now we need to talk about cancer. Okay? Because, you know, you've all been told, don't spend too much time in the sun without sunblock or you'll get skin cancer. Okay, melanomas, for instance, a very common form of cancer in our species. What causes cancer? Well, part of the answer to that, I mean, the stuff we know about, is that at heart, it has to do with mutation. Mutation is when you affect the replication of your DNA in such a way that when the replication occurs, it leads to new properties in the resulting cells that result from replication and then division and so forth. Okay? So most of these mutations are useless and lead to cell death or something else like that. But sometimes, every now and then, a mutation will lead to a survivable outcome, but a cell that can reproduce very rapidly, it's not a normal part of your tissue, and it can lead to the formation of something called a tumor. All right, so tumors are merely cells that have been mutated, now collecting an uncontrolled growth. And the worst thing that can happen is that the cancer cells hitch a ride in the bloodstream to other parts of your body than where they start to become non-localized, and the cancer can spread rapidly at that point. That's really bad, okay? So that's usually when there's very little that can be done left. But if you can catch the tumor early and simply remove the tissue, that's a problem as long as the cancer hasn't spread elsewhere. You have a pretty good chance of having a low probability of recurrence of the cancer. Now, what causes mutations? Okay, mutations are very common. In fact, they're the foundation of our diversity of life on this planet. But mutations themselves are unguided. What matters is that they confer a benefit to surviving in the environment that you're in. Cancers don't seem to obviously confer any benefit. They're just runaway growth, and so they tend to lead to the death of the host. Not always, but in most cases that we're familiar with, the cancers lead to the death of the host. All right, so what causes mutations? Specifically, it's damage to DNA, and there are at least a couple of ways that can happen. Chemically, so you can have molecules like free radicals,
which are very reactive chemicals. Maybe they've had electrons removed from their outer orbits, and now they're looking to bond with something to lower the overall energy of the state. That's what chemistry wants. That's what nature wants. Okay. So alterations to molecules can generate these free radicals. They can interact with segments of DNA, wrap and remove them or damage them, and this can lead to mistakes in copying. Okay. But also, we're exposed to all kinds of ionizing radiation. Right. We get 6.2 microsieverts, millisieverts, microsieverts. No, I've forgotten the name. A tiny bit of radiation from all around us. Half of that is natural. So we're getting exposed to ionizing radiation all the time, and some of the mutations are certainly as a result of direct physical damage from ionizing radiation to the DNA molecules themselves. Milli, yeah, micro would be
so
way
one
too
small.
Yeah, one sievert's lethal, so millisievert sounds about right. So, how much energy is needed to break chemical bonds? Well, interestingly, it's about the same amount of energy required to take those loosely bound electrons off the aluminum. We're talking about a few electron volts, but not less than that. Okay, so 2 to 3 to 4, something like that. And the weakest bonds in nature are hydrogen bonds, but they still require as little as a few electron volts to be broken. So in order to break bonds, in order to alter the chemistry of atoms, you have to put in at least a few electron volts to make that happen. You can heat tissue by vibrating atoms, by rotating molecules, but you can't ionize without energies above a few electron volts. So you need that ionizing radiation to alter chemistry and cause these effects to occur. So what we'll close with today in the last 5 minutes are some of the origins of the claim that mobile phones cause cancer. Okay? Now, one of the earliest recorded mentions of this in a public forum where it may have been taken off into public consciousness after that, at least in the United States, is a man named David Raynard, who went on the Larry King Live show in 1993. Is anyone else besides me noticing a pattern with Larry King Live? No, it's a terrible story because David Raynard's wife died by a cancer in her head. It was a brain cancer. And he went on the show and he made all kinds of claims. Now, this is a summary of this that came from a publication from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute summarizing the history of this. I couldn't find a transcript of the Larry King Live show from 1993, but I'll keep digging. The article says, most people first heard about a possible cell phone cancer connection when David Raynard, whose wife had died of brain cancer, was a guest on the television show Larry King Live. Raynard was suing the cell phone industry, insisting that his wife's cancer had been caused by a cell phone. Quote, she held it against her head and she talked on it all the time, unquote, he explained. It was January 23, 1993. From that day on, it seemed that every media story dealing with cell phones brought up the cancer issue. Okay, so not on a scientific study of the effects of cancer on mobile phones, but a person who, with a very emotional story, went on a program known for very emotional stories and told an emotional story on national cable television, and it just spread. Okay, so that idea just got out there. Now, what then contributes after the fact is poor science reporting after the claim circulates. So let me actually go to some of that. So this is an example of something more recent. CNN had a story on their website, which you can still find. I have a link there. 5 tips to limit your cell phone risk. So you're led to believe that in the intervening years between 1993 and 2008, a lot of research then suggested that mobile phones carry a radiation risk with them. We'll talk more about that in the next lecture. But the article quotes Dr. Deborah Davis, okay, director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Environmental Oncology until 2009, 1 year later. That sounds very impressive. And I'm doing this because a lot of you encounter impressive people when you write your paper. So here, to be impressive, Dr. Scalise and I are going to don these very impressive and medical looking jackets, thanks to the chemistry department for these. Everything I say now carries the weight of medical science behind it. Okay. Now, Dr. Deborah Davis, in this article, is quoted a few times. She says, quote, I hope you're talking to me on a speakerphone, Deborah Davis barks at me when I call her on my cell phone. You better not be holding that phone up to your head. That sounds pretty scary, right? And heaven forbid anyone should carry a cell phone in a pocket or hook you about. Quote, you're just roasting your bone marrow, unquote, Davis said. Okay. Now, we'll come back to this later, but Ms. Davis has an article here on Huffington Post you can look at, where she does a lot of cherry picking and misinterpretation. I'll explain more about that when we talk about the study she's using to back up her claims.
But I'll close with who is Deborah Davis? Okay, because again, these are things I want you to think about when you're writing a paper and you see a claimant, and you also, when you're assessing the claim, you're talking about researchers assessing the claim, you should try to delve just a little bit into who they are. Why should they be treated as an authority? Why should the nation listen to them when they speak about mobile phones and cancer? Okay, so she has degrees in research experience. She has a PhD in something called science studies at the, from the University of Chicago. Now, I looked on the University of Chicago website. If anybody can find me information about their science studies program, I'd love to see it, because it's either not documented or they don't have it anymore and they just didn't put it up on the web by the time the web became popular. Okay. Now, there are science studies at places like, I think, UC San Diego, and it's all history and philosophy and sociology. There's no actual science content. I mean, she's not required to take physics classes or biology classes at the UC San Diego program, which I assume is pattern on programs at the time. Okay? Now, she has a master's of public health from Johns Hopkins, postdoctoral positions at the National Cancer Institute, and the Wikipedia article that is mostly fed from her biography says that she held postdoctoral positions with the National Science Foundation in the history, sociology, and philosophy of science at Catholic University in 1971, and with Worldman Funda and Lorenz KYNG, MD at National Institutes of Health in the 1970s. So what's her medical and patient experience? According to her own biography and her degrees, I mean, she's not an MD. She's not allowed to work with patients, okay? And she doesn't have a PhD in a medical research field. So her patient experience, from that sense, is zero, okay? Peer-reviewed publications on mobile phone radiation, I gave her the benefit of the doubt, or the link between mobile phones and cancer, I looked right at her CV. None. So this is a person who, you know, presumably is a legitimate scientist. I mean, she made it to this directorial position at the University of Pittsburgh. But that doesn't necessarily confer authority in cancer and mobile phones, especially since she herself has not conducted any research in it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, she has let me put it this way. I might not call her a scientist, but 99% of the United States would. And that's what matters here, right?
Well,
because people perceive her as an authority based on that PhD. Fine, that's fine. But, you know, you're also college educated and one of the finest private schools that Texas can offer, so. Yeah. All right, so we'll click this up next time. Right, you wouldn't get medical advice from a sociologist. Exactly. No, that's a different point. We'll repeat that next time. That's good. Okay, great. Okay.
Send
me an email, and then we'll set up a time. Okay?
I wanted to see them later.
Yes, yes, yes.
A two-page paper.
That's fine.
Don't
want to throw it to the side.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that's, do you guys know anything about that for consultants? What are they causing repeated death?